The question is, you can't say, well, whom should you say? It's all the drama. So there are many opinions. There are many opinions. The one opinion is you simply draw up. You leave it to chance. You leave it to chance. You have no right to decide. Because this decision cannot be entrusted to me, because I always prefer the man who is charismatically, I mean, so to say, prominent, who delivers a good charisma, I mean, who deserves, I mean, recognition of the cause. Another opinion is that if you can't save all, so you let all be killed. That is a very, it's an extreme opinion. So don't be saved by the death of others. I'll give you an example. Two people, the famous communist statement. Two people working together. They have only one pitcher of water. One can be saved, the other one cannot. The pitcher of water is interesting. So the law is so. If the pitcher of water is in the possession of one, he may drink the water. But however, if the pitcher of water is not in the possession of one, but in some place, so both must die. And not, and of course, if one is stronger, he could run them into that place and get all of the pitcher of water before the weaker one will get out. Both must die, and no one must be saved. I did that. We are very strict about it. You ask a good question. Did we implement these laws? In the Middle Ages, yes. In the Middle Ages, it's merely in the evil Jew, was first ignorant, but it was a medical person, of course. However, in modern times, of course, I can tell you, but it's indicative of our approach to the individual. Let me give you another example. Perhaps this example is a little more characteristic, because does not deal with emergencies, with situations which are this tragic situation. But it's a general a law pertaining to an everyday situation. By contact with dead bodies, you know that. Mm-hmm. You can find it in the Bible if you want to.
Just for reference, I want to say.
This is Leviticus 21. We all know that the priests, the Kohanim, who were enjoined from defiling themselves by contact with dead bodies, you know that. Mm-hmm. You can find it in the Bible if you want to.
Just for reference, I want to say.
This is Leviticus 21, verse 1. Verse 1, I would say, verse 1:15, or 1-15. There shall none defile himself for the dead among his people. You know, it was very strict rule. Very strict, clear law. And the Kohen who was defiled could not enter the sanctuary or the temple, could not worship. Could not be part of the service. It means simply he was, for a period of 7 days at least, he was excommunicated for the filing of himself in the dead body. The philosophy of it is a different story. There is a certain aversion on the part of Judaism to our death. Judaism felt helpless in the face of death. It's a different story. Yes. The law is as such that the ordinary priest, the Kohen, must not defile himself with dead bodies other than immediate relatives. And these are all the past generalities. Wife, children, brother and sister, and parents. However, it was forbidden to the high priest to come in contact and contaminate himself with any dead, even if they are his closest relatives. As it is said in the chapter I referred to, nor his father. Or you can find him another. There are other people who attend to the funeral when the Tatra arrives. You want to express your emotions, your love for your father, you are forbidden to do so. But if the high priest was traveling on the highway and found a dead body, just of course, state of disintegration, so he must take care of the body and bury it. He must not defile himself with the beloved father and mother, because there are others who will make the appropriate risk. Yet if he comes across a dead body that has been dumped somewhere, murdered in the field or in the woods, he sits down to defile himself, to preoccupy himself with its interment. Now this is a law. Now let me just dramatize it with this law.
But it is true, I mean, and that affects the Talmud spoke of such an interest. We may imagine the following complication. The following complication which may arise on such an occasion. The date is Erev Yom Kippur, the date preceding Yom Kippur. The high priest has readied himself for the great day of atonement for months and weeks. Because on the day of atonement, he will represent the Jewish people before the Almighty in the inner sanctum. Now, by the sanctum, sanctorum, man. Will allow to enter only the high priest. For the great ceremonial of the service of the Day of Atonement, this ceremonial could only, this service could only be performed by the high priest. No ordinary priest had access to the temple on the day. And only one time could appear as the spokesman representing the Jewish community on that great holy sacred day for the high priest. Whoever has even a fleeting knowledge of the history of the Second Commonwealth knows what the service on the Day of Atonement meant to the people. Sacrifices, confession, kneeling. The high priest on that day was, so to say, the beloved hero of the Jewish community. We have Roman sources, not only Jewish sources, Roman sources, Roman historians, recorded the ceremonial how the high priest was escorted from his house into the temple and taken back at night, back to his home. I mean, he was the most admired person. I mean, an echo of this you can still find in this service on the Day of Atonement read in the synagogues and temples. How great was the high priest when he left the sanctuary. The man was a man whom millions admired and for whose safety they ardently prayed. And I'm not exaggerating there. I'm not dramatizing there. The passage in Ben Sira, we have from the famous poet of the second cover, Ben Sira, apocryphal, which we still recite on the Day of Atonement, reveals to us, abounds in superlatives describing, portraying the high priest on the Day of Atonement. We still hear the ecstatic voices of the crowd to watch the high priest performing the magnificent act. And yet, this is just an introduction, and yet, the high priest, this day, Erev Yom Kippur, just a few hours before sunset, the high priest is about to perform the most glorious service of the year, with his eagerly anticipated by the entire community, took a walk in the woods and found the body. And there is a question in the Talmud whether what should come first. Shall we just walk back to town? Nothing there. Back to town. Not far from town, a few miles from town. Go back or ride back to town and dump on a horse and tell the people there is a dead body. Take care of him so he shouldn't touch the body because he must be fit for the service, for the performance in the temple. Or he should disregard everything. Forget the whole world, the community, and what we have to do tomorrow. And bend down, pick up the dead body on his shoulder and bring it to the town, of course. And of course, and it was a question, and the question was answered unequivocally, yes, he must not leave the body even for once. Must forget his life. All his commitment to the community. His ceremonial, his pride of being able to perform this great ceremonial and enter in the sanctuary, the sanctum sanctorum, and attempt to debut, to become a great figure. And yet the high priest is about to perform the most glorious service of the year, which even anticipates that the entire community must take care of his burial, and thus defy him and disqualify himself from worshipping God on the most solemn day of the year. The absence of the high priest and the people always, they were a bit superstitious. If something happened to the high priest, it wasn't that honor at that time. And the people, the absence of the high priest, may cancel out the whole service because there was no one else to substitute him. No one else was to play for the very comfort service. And they used to train the high priest for weeks. How to perform it? It may cancel out the whole service. It cancel out the whole service. On that day, since in some cases there might be no one to replace him, still the high priest must dismiss from his mind the great ceremonial, the community, the temple, the royal and joy associates with the service, and devote himself to the dream task of a great of grave digging and carrying the dead body, which in a state of disintegration and decomposition. Why? Why should it disappoint the entire community and forfeit the noblest of experiences, the one of catharsis and purification at the Day of Atonement? Who was this person whose body was abandoned? Let's understand. Who was this person whose body was abandoned? The king? And the king's body is taken care of. The archbishop comes to his funeral. Oh, certainly not an important figure. Some person whose body could be abandoned in a, and no one demanded the body, asked for the body. Some anonymous being. Perhaps a vagabond or a leper. A leper usually lives in the woods. Did not admit it to the community. A leper of a sinner was expelled, excommunicated from his hometown. Why should the great aristocrat and the high priest was considered as the aristocrat of the community, who is charged with responsibility for the spiritual welfare of the Jewish community, decide himself and thus not realize the hopes and expectations of millions of people? What is the answer for the sake of burying a vagabond? Some anonymous person. The answer to it is a simple one. The greatness of the individual is the supreme principle and generator. It reigns supreme. The inner worth of the person, which is dependent not upon accomplishment and success, but upon his uniqueness and loneliness, is the foundation of Judaism. Each person, however humble his station is or what, and however downtrodden and anonymous he is, however inferior, he is in every respect to his fellow man, however poor in attainment, is each person is blessed with something singular, and it's a factor he is great. And the whole service, the idea of forgiveness and mercy and catharsis and the Day of Atonement, the message of the day, the sanctity of the temple, would be stripped of their meaning and become a mockery if the person who is selected to represent the Jewish community before the Almighty did not appreciate the glory of the individual and the worth and dignity of the helpless, forlorn, the wretched person, the vagabond, the tucker, the prostitute, who might have lost everything, everything in life, but not the image of that. This is a law. It's very characteristic of our approach.
The earlier
film, right.
The concept of the community,
or the concept of the individual, is something that Judaism didn't completely accept either. Yes, I already said, yes. I said so. As far as the individual is concerned, he must raise the community above Israel. As far as others are concerned, he must raise the Tao above the community. You see, this is the dialectical swing. I must do everything in order to promote the welfare of the community. And even if supreme sacrifice is required, who comes to see from us? On the contrary, when you see me, then I am above the community. You have no right to say that millions of people expect atonement should come first and the poor individual should be buried later. You must play the individual above the community. This is how Judaism works.
As you're talking about man's responsibility in relation to man, but it also includes, although I imagine it extends itself to every man, irrespective of color, creed, religion, etc.
Certainly. I want you to understand that when we speak, we operate these two concepts in Judaism. The question is our parochial approach and our universal approach. You know, many followers of Jewish people accuse Judaism of being too parochially minded. But all the laws they promulgate and formulate, no more. But they see the laws apply only to their own kind, to the Jew, but not to the Gentile, you know that. Basically, okay. I mean, I want to be very truthful with you. I don't want to engage in apologetics. We operate these two concepts. We speak of the dignity of the personality. We also speak of the sanctity of the person. Until now, I've been speaking not about sanctity of the personality. I've never mentioned this word, yeah? I've never mentioned about the dignity of the personality. many laws come under the category of dignity of personality. Other laws come under the category of sanctity of the personality. If you ask me whether we are parochial or universal in our approach, I'll give you the straight answer. And this is the true answer. If dignity of the personality is involved, there is no distinction as to race, color, religion between the Bushman in Australia and the great Jew, the great Jewish scholar in New York or in Jerusalem. If it's a question of the sanctity of the personality, we speak as a charismatic community, a chosen community. And of course, the chosen community are committed to the Jewish community. But social ethics does not deal with the sanctity of the personality, but with the dignity of the personality. So all ethical laws, all civil laws, are equally applied to all men. Yes, sir.
This law that you just elaborated on, doesn't that somehow contravene the basic thing that you find yourself? Let me clear that in mind.
Huh?
You made the analogy of the parrot analogy without words, without physical attachment. So you are filled with the love for the sanctity of the body, of the physical body.
Nothing.
This is
just an example of this.
Important.
No, the body is important because the body, basically, if you are made of you. She didn't make guilty, but from Christianity, the one that's when Christianity spoke at man, it had a mind, his soul, or spiritual man, whatever. Judaism always, in this regard, Judaism is very close to the scientific expression. Judaism looks upon man, first of all, as a body. That's why the body, the beginning of the personality, is reflected on the body.
Even to the exclusion of what the appearance of the high priest of the service would do, the inner self of the whole community.
Yes. You see, again, we are so much influenced by Christian concept, the spiritual meaning of that heart. We have never operated with such concept. Yes, sir. Yes.
It seems that there's a kind of spiritual commitment of man to man, even before man to God in this situation, or man to the God in man. If the high priest do it.
I understand your question. Let me answer this. I intended to talk about it, but I'll talk later about it short. You see, one should ask me, once a Christian theologian asks me, what do I consider the greatest achievement of Judaism? What is the most singular contribution that Judaism made to welfare, the spiritual welfare of mankind? Of course, it's all monotheism here, but this is already a long phrase. As you say in Yiddish, Sata Bot has a long beard. And monotheism, it's not about monotheism, of course, Jewish religion is monotheistic, but you may find monotheistic philosophies among the Greeks as well, not being aware of Jewish monotheism, because even Egyptian culture are aware of them. To introduce a monotheistic religion, monotheistic concept. This is not a letter. Yeah, all right. But what is important, the greatest, in my opinion, the greatest contribution of Judaism made to the spiritual welfare of mankind, is that Judaism unified and combined cult to the ethos. If you will take a great man like Socrates or Plato, so he said, the gods, how do you serve the gods? Oh, God, it doesn't matter whether gods or gods. How do you serve them? How do you serve them? You have to satisfy, discharge your specific duties to other sacrifices. Prayer, service, build temples, erect statues, honor, sing hymns to them. But the gods of the Olympus, they are not interested in my relationship to my fellow man. This is my own business. It's my own problem. Philosophy will deal with it. So, of course, pagan religion had no ethics. All the gods they were interested in was in cults, in cultic Catholicism. As a matter of fact, the gods themselves were of very lax morals. I mean, you know, you couldn't trust them. They were deceitful, they were lusty, full of lust and gluttony, and sneaky. Clear of you, as you know, the Greek mythology. And this is true of every pagan culture. I'm pointing out, the Greek
Because the Greek is culturally, especially the civilization, it made a tremendous contribution to Tzatzat, I mean, the advancement of society. Judaism was the first religion in which came. You serve God, all that certain form of service to God, cultic service. But this is not a man service. God is interested in your ethical life, in morality. You can serve him not only by sacrificing. Sacrificing is an unimportant detail in Judaism. Of course, and I always said, an institutionalized religion must have some tangible forms of worship, otherwise it cannot exist, disappear in thin air. But I'm interested in how you treat your next fellow man, how you treat the laborer, how you treat the poor, how you treat the pauper. But see, if you subject yourself, mark your hand and support the man who is about to fall. I mean, support him, I mean, how you treat your father and mother, how the king, how he treats his citizens. I mean, the ethos, you serve God not only by sacrifice, but also, and perhaps mainly, by realizing the moral law which was introduced by God. This is very important. You take the Decalogue. I mean, if you count all the injunctions, I would say the precepts in the Decalogue, how many are occupied in this cult, in the cultic performance, how many? Not even one. Even the Sabbath has a social meaning to us. In other words, your slaves and your ox and the beast in the field should rest. And you should remember that you were a slave in Egypt. And that's why I want you to handle your slave in a decent manner. Well, this was the first foundation of Judaism. Of course, we have an institution of sacrifice too. But it's secondary important. And what did all the prophets preach? I mean, people say the prophets were opposed to sacrifice, to worship, to cult. It isn't true. It's again a mistake on the part of the Bible, because you are not opposed to cult. And men must engage in cultic performances. You see, you cannot take religion and equate it completely with the ethos. You feel that you miss something. There is in man something which demands, I would say, expression and manifestation in cultic forms, in through a service. There is a service. We have a service, a temple service. We have prayer, but they are secondary. That's why I say, when liberal Judaism says the temple is the center of Jewish life. The conservative Jews say, I mean, is the synagogue the center? And now Orthodox Rabbis begin to say that the Knesset is the center. I say they are all lying. Neither the Reform Temple, nor the conservative synagogue, nor the Orthodox Knesset. The center of Jewish life is the home, the street, the shop, I mean, the nightclub, the beach, I mean, the highway. I mean, God is everywhere. Of course, it's very nice to come into temple. If the temple is reflect my life outside of the temple. But if there is the great gap, you must say, is God separating my mundane life, my life, my behavior in my office, my relationship to my employees, I mean, and my humble attitude in the temple, there's the God, that's what the prophet say. What's the use of finally sacrifice if your hands are stained with blood? No contradiction. Judaism always requires unity. Unity means consistency, identity, the same person. You see, what is the trouble with Catholicism? The trouble with Catholicism is, psychologically, that the Catholic, basically, is a schizophrenic. He has a split in his personality. I can imagine, we'll take an example, take Franco in Spain. Of course, his hands are stained with blood. So I can imagine very well, and I believe I've never seen him, so I imagine that Franco comes in Easter Sunday, and every Sunday attends Mass, he's a pious devout Catholic, he comes into the cathedral in Madrid, kneels, bends his head against the stones of the cathedral, and the stones were the cathedral, and says the famous Latin dictum, non mea voluntas set tua fiat, not my will, but yours should become real. And he knows himself. He said, he knows it. He taught hypocrisy. I don't say it's hypocrisy. He is humble and he submits himself to the divine will, to divine judgment, and prays for atonement, and he delivers himself into God's hand. Who I should say is a hypocrite? And the word hypocrisy we used to often. But this prevails as long as it is enveloped by the shadows of the cathedral. As long as he is sort of intoxicated by the fragrance of the incense, which is burnt on the altar. As long as as the Savior, I mean, looks upon him from the crucifix. But the moment he steps out of the threshold, you see, of the cathedral, into clear sunlight, so you can find on the threshold of the cathedral a death sentence against our young revolutionary. But such a thing to Judaism is the most abominable, the most incomprehensible, most paradoxical experience. That's your question. You ask me, there is a duty, yes. There is a duty to God. But the duty to bury the dead is also a duty to God. And the question how you serve God, through bringing sacrifices or through burying the dead, is lonely person. The second duty comes, takes precedence over the first one. All right, let's stop now. Of course, it's a continuation of the lecture you delivered me 3 weeks ago, I believe, yes? You'll excuse me that I couldn't be here last Thursday in Washington. And this is a continuation of the lecture. If you will just try to pick up the thread. And that we discuss the problem of the, what you call luminous men for themselves. Men without accomplishments for society. Men who haven't contributed anything to the hard advancement of mankind. But the worth of man isn't himself. The rest of it is discussed and how Judaism in many forms, in halakhic level, has emphasized time and again the worth of the person without accomplishment. And I said that Judaism reached paradoxically, and you would say has formulated a paradoxical ideal. It means the apotheosis of anonymity. The anonymous person. And one is anonymous, apparently, he didn't distinguish himself, but because he's anonymous, so there is inner worth to him. This is the Judaic approach, perhaps the impractical approach. And that time, I gave an example how the community must not sacrifice individual, even if the individual, I mean, is ethically, morally, I mean, actually a corrupt personality. And also about the case, the clear case of the high priest finding an abundant cough on the day preceding Yom Kippur, how he must defile himself. And bury the cough, although by so doing he'll disqualify himself from officiating at the service. It means the most solemn service of the year is being overridden by the need of the part of the kingdom to understand the tragedy and also the worth of the abundant, lonely person. Now I'll continue with a few more examples, because I'm very typical, it's very tender, it's very typical of Judaism. Interesting also is the maxim in the Talmud. Agra de Kala Duchtor. Kala used to be the famous assemblies in Talmudic times, which scholars from all parts of, say, of Babylonia and Palestine. Used to get together at Istanbul, and it was academic, actually, I mean, academic conferences, and all kinds of topics were discussed and analyzed, and people gave like lectures and so forth. And basically, Talmud, the Talmudic literature, is a result of such assemblies. So the Talmud says that the participants in the Kala assembly, they called Kala, the participants in the Kala assembly, probably it is. It's due to the fact that there were universal assemblies, like the Catholics call our ecumenical, I mean, universal assemblies, I mean, they discussed a variety of subjects in those assemblies, I mean. And actually, those assemblies were you may say they were legislative in character, I mean, they used to lay down the law, formulate, interpret the law, and actually, I mean, Judaism, Halakhic Judaism, is a result of those assemblies. So the participants in the Kala assemblies will be rewarded in accordance, rewarded by God. And let's not forget that Talmud Torah, I mean, the study of the law, the study of the Torah, is considered by Judaism one of the most significant deeds in the part of man. So it will be rewarded not in accordance with their intellectual achievements, but with the amount of discomfort they underwent during the sessions. So for instance, two people, for instance, it's very strange, two people participated in a Torah symposium. One was bright and scholastically well-trained, and hence enjoyed the discussion, brilliance of the debaters, and the ingenuity of the intellectual combat at the symposium. The other one, with a very limited capacity, bordering almost on the gout, did not grasp the fine point of discussion. He could not follow the reasoning of the opponent. He was bored and lonely. He felt that he did not belong to that circle of great intellect. I mean, if I should come into a society of theoretical physicists, I mean, I'll feel like that. So, that he was an outsider who could never be integrated into the world of thought. And yet, he diligently attended all sessions, listened carefully to each word. After that, he could not tear himself away from the academy. Why? I mean, men act sometimes irrationally. If he didn't understand, didn't he read? So I asked also, why do you sit here and listen to me? Because I don't say anything new. Basically, what I say is commonplace in Judaism. It's the truth. And I believe you know as much as I do about it. Perhaps I formulate it a little different. But people are irrational. Many times I happen, and many times I come to the time people come to listen to my speeches and lectures. So there is nothing new in me. I mean, I'm not a sense of false modesty. I mean, what I say is something which everybody feels. I try to spell it out. But somehow people in irrational manner sometimes. He could not tear himself away from the academy. He was very uncomfortable, depressed and angered by the fact. Of course, in that case, that he somehow was outside of the debate, outside of that circle. And he wasted his time. The psychological reason why he did it is irrelevant. And simply, I mean, immaterial. The fact that he felt uncomfortable because of certain either drawbacks or because the people bore him. He knew more than they. God will measure the reward not by the standards of accomplishment, but by those of pain and suffering, the individual experiences. It means, Agre de Kalle Duchte means reward for a scholastic session. Depends how hard the bench was, the bench on which the person was sitting. Just means pressure. Yehadus insisted upon full axiological democracy. You see, this is the kind of democracy which modern men don't understand. Modern men understand political democracy, racial reforms, understand also perhaps economic democracy, as the, so to say, socialist countries claim to understand. It isn't true, perhaps, but he doesn't understand democracy axiological, as to the worst of the question. But the great scholar, scientist, and the little person have the same work that modern men didn't understand, and I don't believe I understand, and perhaps no one understands. But Judaism insisted upon it. Judaism was both realistic at times, and at times it was daydreaming. Completely caught in the web of fantasy and imagination. But it was a beautiful fantasy, at least. I mean, fortunately, I'll tell you frankly, for instance, now with the emergence of the state of Israel, I utter one prayer, and simply my mind many times is disturbed. We have a beautiful habit. And to say that we were angels is hard to say, but more or less, the pages of our history are not stained with blood and tears, and injustice and brutality, as the pages of history are near of European society, let us take the feudal times or the medieval times. Simple reason, not because perhaps we were superior to them, we simply did not encounter the challenge. We never had a state, we never had political problems. Each one lived for himself. A private person cannot meet a private person, a weak person, a persecuted person. A person who did not have anything to say could not commit the injustices which, for instance, France or Germany or feudal England committed only in the Middle Ages, of course. But what, I mean, if I ask, what if our history had been different, had taken a different course? What if we had been a state in the Middle Ages? How would we have acted? just like if you loved, or you would have acted differently. The person today gets it. I have no answer to that. Who knows? To say hypothetically why, how we would have acted is ridiculous. Now with the state of Israel and the test is hard. We are facing the test. Will you behave like any other state ethically? And basically, any state is not ethical. I don't believe that a state that itself implies an intrinsic contradiction to ethics. The best one. Will we act differently? Will we, restrain ourselves from engaging in certain practices which are in conflict with the basic Judaic ethics? Or will you temptation? Of course, a few experiences are not very assuring. Others somehow hold out a hope. I don't know. But this is, to me, this is the basic problem with which we diaspora Jews are faced with regard to the state of Israel. Never mind something. Something is a different story. I'll come to the problem yet. But the problem is, here we have an opportunity. The Jews are the rulers. They legislate the laws. They are, so to say, the master. We have never been masters. They've always been the subordinates, followers. Since the destruction of the Second Temple, 1900 years ago, quite a time, which is a long time. Now we have the masters. Of course, we're a small land in a narrow strip along the Eastern Mediterranean. Will we act like masters? Or will we understand it that Judaism does not know the concept of master and slave, victor and vanquished, powerful and weak? This is my problem with regard to the state of Israel. The whole Jewish history will be interpreted in terms of what the state of Israel will do in the next 50 years. The state of Israel will not live up to the great hopes and challenges of Judaic ethics. I'm not speaking about economics and science. This is a secondary problem to me. Then the whole Jewish history will appear in a different light. People will reinterpret Jewish history. So the Jews will announce different because the students didn't have the opportunity to be wicked. Now, as soon as they got opportunity, they proved to the world they're not better than anybody else.
Are you talking about being wicked as a state, as a government, or as individuals?
It's both. It's for the threatened.
So why didn't Jews have an opportunity to be wicked in the past?
Okay, wickedness always is an expression, well, is interdependent with simply this power. If a man has that power, he cannot be wicked.
He didn't have
unless,
power in the state, but in his individual life and in his group he had that power.
Yes, but don't forget that the Jews, even if the group had power, but the group itself was persecuted, you understand? The powerful group within the Jewish community was persecuted by the outside community. So the person who was about to persecute the weaker one, he himself knew what persecution meant. There wasn't a single Jew, the most powerful Jew, who did not face and experience persecution. And the experience of persecution itself is already a mitigating circumstance. And if I experience something unpleasant on the part of someone who is more powerful than I cannot simply pass on this experience to the person who is subordinated to me. Sometimes psychologically you say the one who is weaker out in his office so becomes a tyrant at home. But this is basically an exception. That's why the Jews were persecuted race simply felt that compassion for the weak. But if the Jews should become not a persecutor race, but an equal to others, how will they act? I don't know. I hope you act differently. I hope that such laws as such committees as are un-American, they are committed on American activities and such distorted laws, the law pertaining, the one pertaining to immigration, cannot be passed by the Knesset in Israel. But to tell you, I'm going to take a note now for that, I would be a bit over optimistic. Some voices I hear sometimes in the debate in the Knesset, which I dislike. I mean, it's just I'm thinking out aloud. It's not a part of my lecture. And to me, this is the most important problem. The Jew of the diaspora should be proud of Israel, regardless of what the Zionist or he does not really attribute himself to the political movement. But still, Israel is Jewish, If we don't consider Israel Jewish, at least our question is to consider Israel Jewish, It's certainly a Jewish institution, never mind. About, never mind what our feelings about Israel are. And the question is not whether Israel will defeat the Arabs on the field of battle, and we are proud of that, but victorious army is not exclusively a Jewish, so to say, institution. Whether we will defeat our evil within our own community will be victorious in this field. To me, this is the most important problem. That is that. To say what will happen, well, there's got to be a prophet, I don't know. Okay. Of course,
Can you realize it's possible in a state which can turn socialistic and live up to the debate? I believe that one of the topics when I reach this topic today or not is the problem of the non-religious Jew. When I have come to this topic, I'll discuss it. Did you mention it?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, but I don't know whether I'll get to it. I mean, I
said something else before with it, Mr. Clarendon. You said something about the modern man cannot, is not interested in the individual, and that the small individual doesn't count as much as the large individual. That's not a concept of modern man today, that we don't have this sort of thing. It's only an old Judaic concept.
I thought you said it. Modern man, his quest for democracy has not simply introduced equality as to the worth of individuals.
Except for this, we as social workers like to talk about ourselves about being interested in the dignity of every individual and every human being.
Yes, correct. But I'll tell you, as social workers, you deal with small people. Because big people don't need help.
But they give us the money to get help.
Yeah, oh yeah. I would like to ask you, and please excuse my eloquence, perhaps I become a bit impudent, about your inner feelings when for instance, someone comes to you and you're a consultant, one who needs help, a poor man. Okay. Yeah. So you have the same approach to him as you have when you talk, for instance, to the governor of the state, to Nelson Rockefeller. I would ask you to do a bit of soul searching. It's the same approach. You feel emotionally, that you treat this one just like you would.
It should be a very poor professor who is teaching me something.
Yes.
I have the same reaction.
A good professor whom you consider a scholar. Yeah, yeah, because then he's a good person in your eyes. Because he has contributed
and
to society.
For the poor little Malamud who comes in, who
he's
no great man of the community.
Yes.
Just an ordinary little man, but he has something, that's all. Because we see in every individual something.
You should see it. You should see it. It's more a norm than a fact, I would say. It's an idea. I speak as a rabbi. I certainly supposed to see in everybody. So the reflection of our father Abraham. I should, but I don't. In regard to me, there is quite a gap, a gulf between practice and an idea. And I believe the same gulf, could be found in the field of social work. I know that when I speak to a person who is powerful, rather than afraid of him, I'm not afraid of him, I don't need to say that. But this is the person who is prominent as a scientist, as a political figure. But even the man who is prominent in the field of economic accomplishment, it's a rich. Not that I need anything. I always discover myself, to my own surprise, a sense of reverence. When I take a taxi and I give a tip to the cabman, there's no reverent attitude on my part. That's just what I discover about myself. I believe that this experience, it can be universalized and generalized, not like everybody, because I'm not worth it, but nor am I better. So they say, and Judaism was stressing this point vigorously, passionately. Now, of course, and this again, as I said last time, because men, there are two personalities. There's the charismatic personality, and I say charismatic Adam, who has a special experience. And who knows who has a deeper existential experience? And who has a warmer heart? And who has a more tender soul? The great philosopher Kant or a Potter or a Benner? Very hard to say.
the famous statement in Talmud, "May Chazid Damach Sumek Tzei Dumadama Dechavas." How do you know that your blood is red? Perhaps the blood of your fellow man, your neighbor, is redder, is more red. It's not a question of redness of the blood. Who knows who is greater, you and or I? Measured by contributions, there are objective criteria which we can judge the greatness of a person. Measured by the inner experience, there are no criteria. Only God can measure, not even me. This is exactly what it is.
Rabbi, you used the word a great deal, existentialist experience.
I didn't say existentialist experience. So existentialist means the experience of the existentialist. I'm not an existentialist, so I cannot know. I said existential experience. It is the experience that we call the ego consciousness, the ego awareness, that I am the experience of the I. Of the I. But when we say existentialist experience means the experience of the existentialist philosopher, it's already a doctrine. I say existential experience, the experience of my own existence, you understand? That I am, who am I? As I said last lecture, because no one can answer the question, who I am. I can answer the question, who I am in terms of contributions. It is a question of mass and energy equation. I cannot answer the question, who I am in terms of intrinsic worth. I only can answer who I am with regard to others. I cannot answer who I am with regard to myself. There is again, I must refer to Peretz. I think a lot about him, although he was ideologically, he was a secular Jew, I'm a religious Jew. There is a novel, a short story by him. It's called The Meshuggah Bakland. The crazy, I don't know how to translate
there
that.
Well.
Huh?
There too well.
Never do well. This is the technical. It's a bit clumsy, I would say. The problem is a man bottomless to idol, not to contribute. The man who didn't contribute anything, the man didn't do anything. It's playboys, but not in the sense of playboys, a certain derogatory. Meaning, but it's not his daughter. A man who's not fitted into the world to serve society. I mean, who is fit?
The German Talgenist.
Yes, Talgenist is, and it's not bad. It's a bit. There's a little resemblance.
Rabbi, that's an example of our inability to communicate feelings.
Yes, we are bad, all bad. So, and the whole question is the Meshuggah Bakland said, who am I? Who am I? It means that it begins of talking in his primitive manner. Here in this little town, in this little village, people know me. Why do they know me? They know my address, they know my name, they know my jacket, they know my suit, they know my hat, so they recognize me. But who am I? Am I the suit I wear? Am I the house I'm residing in? It means, can I be explained to others in terms of the externals, of contributions? Or my existence expresses itself in more intrinsic terms, in inwardness. So what does my inwardness stand for? And this is a question which is many times disturbing me as well. I don't feel myself a butterfly, but it's a question. Am I only that what I appear to others to be? I'm more than that. Now, Judaism, in formulating its social ethics, and I tell you again, gentlemen, I have to beg your pardon. Whatever I say is, to me, it's truism. It's simply it is commonplace. But somehow, and I don't believe that there is anything new, but I have to speak about it because something most elementary and most axiomatic things are many times unknown, or not so much unknown, they haven't been spelled out. That's all. But they're axiomatic in Judaism. Judaism is formulating its social ethics was particularly concerned with human dignity and the awareness of self-worthiness. Self-worthiness. One of the most basic rights of the individual, we have many rights, basic rights, of American Declaration of Independence, the Constitution is based on natural rights. so-called Lex Latuna. About the 17th century spokes of matrimony in the store. The Roman place. But there is a certain right which, I don't know, Judaism has formulated, and I haven't found this such a formula in any other system of ethics. One of the most basic rights of the individual is the right to know and to experience personal dignity and worth in living. The right to dignity. We have the right to work, not in the sense of the legislation of being, I mean, built of being introduced in the various legislation, but I mean the right to work, the right to defense, to self-defense, the right to live, but the right to dignity. What does it mean? Anyone who interferes with the intrinsic prerogative of men and angels who wants self-respect, being inflict injury not on the body. The body injury, everybody understands. I must not. But I inflict injury upon the self-respect of a person who will be severely punished by God. To insult to one's neighbor or to hurt his pride, and don't please interpret that in terms of liable and slander. Not slander, not liable. Slander or liable is something else. Slander or liable means if I indict him, if I accuse him of something he didn't do, all right, it's not spreading malicious rumors, just an unintentional injury. I mean, inflicted upon his pride. An insult. To hurt his pride or embarrass him, even causing embarrassment. Particularly if this embarrassment is caused to him in public, in the presence of others. He is equated by our moral codes as murder. Yes, I mean, I'm not going to correct this. And let us not forget, and I'll tell you why it was classified as murder. Let us not forget that the Hebrew term for murder is shvichut damim, bloodshed. Bloodshed. And under this heading, semantically, when you say bloodshedding or bloodshed, any painful experience, the Allah understood it, any painful experience which causes a flush of anger chain, of sudden peeling, of a frightened face, is an act of bloodshed. Because what is mean, Malbin? Malbin Hebrew means one pales. If I pale, I felt embarrassed. I felt frightened. I felt injured. I felt hurt. There's a change in the blood circulation, the temper of blood circulation. You see, peeling on you. It's a flash of anger, of anger chain, of sudden peeling. Of a frightened face is an act of murder. And the famous expression, whoever shames his, not only shame, hurts the pride of his friend, but of his neighbor in public, he is treated or penalized as if he had committed murder and had killed him. And the Talmud continues and said, Noach lelo Adam, shiyat lato lekif shanayesh, bal yalvim pechavere b'rabim. One should incur rather martyrdom than embarrass his comrade in public. Amalvim pechavere b'rabim ein lechelek leilam haba. Whoever shames his neighbor in the presence of others will not share in the world to come. Please, the world to come, the attitude in the future world, are denied to one who shamed his friend. It's interesting. It was not denied to the murderer, but it was denied to the one who shamed his friend. Because shaming a friend in public is many times more subtle and more cruel than to kill a person. This was the opinion. So the right to dignity is many times placed above the right to live. Although, gentlemen, the right to self-respect was bestowed by the Creator upon everyone without, upon the king and upon the potter, special emphasis was placed upon the dignity of the humble. Of course, the king is also. I mean, to shame the president of the United States is not very ethical deed. And believe me, many times when I read the press, a pre-election press, a pre-election idea. I listened to pre-election campaign speeches. Of course, they speak about the most powerful person in the United States. But many times, I think, I try to take, for instance, a speech, a Texas speech, the Times always accommodates me and just read powerful, set lines and try to classify them under Jewish ethical categories. What are Talmudic scholars? Would they start if they had read the speech delivered about anybody? Shaming, insulting, hurting, abusive. No good purpose, perhaps. But this is not. And many times I think how it, within the framework of Jewish ethics, the political campaign is complete impossibility. Impossibility. Because when our people in Israel, when they get engaged, become engaged in the political campaign, and they are not sure they're either of objectives and compliments and about opponents, so they are not Jews anymore. Sorry, but political campaign is not a Jewish institution. It's not always not a Jewish institution. It's completely abhorrent to the religious conscience. Unless you... It's not only you must not say falsehoods. You must not hurt anybody if you tell the truth. This business of exposing a person. It's a good piece of journalism, of course. People get the Pulitzer Prize for them. But from a Judaic viewpoint, it is something which is obnoxious, it's faulty. It's a crime. This is the real amalgam to the Haveri Barabim, shaming one in the public. Either a larger public than the one which reads the press, and even with regard to truth.
Well, suppose somebody has done something genuinely wrong.
It's always a good question. Of course, such type of idealism may many times be exploited in order to tolerate evil. Correct, you're right. But there are limits. For instance, if the person, what we call, becomes a voidist, it means he's a menace to public safety, then you expose him, but also when you expose the wicked, there are many ways of exposing him. You don't dramatize it, you don't play it up on him, you know, you don't try to appeal to the lower instincts of the crowd. I mean, you know how journalism, particularly the yellow side, I mean, but such things. But there's got to be a menace to public safety. What is called Reydish in Hebrew in a minute, without being in a society. I'll give you an example. For instance, you know what it means in Jewish life, meant a Moser. You know what a Moser is? One who squeals. Squeals, informer. Of course, in the Middle Ages, I mean, the informer was the individual. I mean, he was a public menace, no doubt. It's interesting. So Moser always, the Jews interpreted Moser in terms of fetching down information to the enemy. This is basically espionage, the enemy. And since the Jews in the Middle Ages were surrounded by enemies, so any information passed down to the authorities was classified as betrayal, as espionage and misservice. But basically, Jewish ethics say that even if there is a Jewish state, if there were a Jewish state, and one knows that something, that a crime which is never committed. A crime in which public safety is not involved, as you know. But it's a crime. He has the right to inform the Jewish authorities here. But you are not a judge.
In other words, how about a witness in a trial?
You are right.
In a civil matter.
Unless he's summoned.
Unless he's summoned. He has no right to offer to appeal.
Not in civil matters. Civil matters, in money matters.
Yes.
In money matters. Yes. In money matters, he has no right. He is not obligated unless he is summoned by the party which is interested. But money matters, many times, simply is not informing. It's a question only of a deal, where the person himself is not involved in that. The question in criminal matters, is basically most scholars say, unless the best deal, the court, forces him to testify. He must not volunteer information. Unless this type of crime is endangered simply in the life of other individuals. Then it's done. In general, Judaism has grappled with the problem of judging people. Even the problem of a court was a mystery to Jews. How can a Jew judge a fellow man? Is he perfect that he can pass on judgment? But on others, this was a... And that's why the position of the dayan, of the so-called justice, judge, is a very precarious one in Jewish ethics. The Talmud says the judge should see himself as this hell, the purgatory, is underneath, and divine wrath up from above. It's a very unpleasant position, you see, to be between the devil and the blue sea, you see. And many times when I've never been in court, but when I read about the reasoning which accompany any sentence, then I feel that the judge considers himself, he's so complacent about himself, and he considers himself perfect and entitled to pass on judgment on others. I always think about the Jewish approach to the judge. And that's why the Talmudic scholars recommended that no one should accept the judgeship, an appointment as a judge. Because it's something inhuman in that. Only one has a right to judge people, and this is God. No one else. And basically, judging people is an evil with which the halacha, which was realistic, had to come to terms. You see, many things in Judaism is not that were not liked. And Judaism accepted them reluctantly. But what could you do? After all, we need a society, we need some assemblies of order, we need a state. Well, I could be in war of all against all, in the expression of Pops, you see.
I think that is quite a struggle within Jewish circles around the Rosenberg trial and Judge Kaufman and his...
Yes?
I am familiar with two of the rabbis tried to get to him to discuss with him the Jewish ethics of
Extremely wrong. Basically, I believe that in the case of the Rosenberg trial, I don't believe that a man was so stupid as to give a death sentence for espionage in peacetime, I believe, wasn't it? Because, we simply were small people. It was the amount of damage they did to the safety of the United States could not be determined. And when this famous atomic scientist in England, Fuchs, betrayed, So certainly, if Russia had taken advantage of our research, indeed, information came to them through Fuchs, but not through small, ignorant people. It was terrible, because in my opinion, it was murder. In my opinion, it was murder. It was actually murder.
Aren't you, in a sense, judging yourself now?
Yes, you're right. You're right. I shouldn't say that. You're right. Mea maxima culpa. Mea maxima culpa. My sin. You're right. I'm not denying it. You're right. But sometimes you can't
prepare.
The only difference. What can you do? He did not do a service to the United States. So. He did not enhance the prestige of the United States, nor did he enhance, so to say, the security of the United States. The United States is secure enough. That's not necessary. Of course, it was the McCarthy atmosphere, this hysterical and quiet and fierce. See, he was afraid. What bothers my mind is that what he says when I can't fall asleep at night, I think, what if this judge, who are not a Jew, but a Christian, would be here? Rend up a death sentence. And I'm inclined to say no.
Suppose his wife's name was Rosenberg.
Huh? Beg your pardon? And suppose, the two little people were not Jews. It was an unfortunate coincidence of a Jew versus a Jew. And that's what is there in the morning.
Is that from a Jewish point of view that you're objecting to this thing, or from some other point of view? Is it part of halakha, for instance, that man, no man should have judged at all?
No.
Or that he made that this was the wrong judgment?
This is very heavy judge, this sentence. I'm not criticizing the sentence. No. At least it's Jewish viewpoint. Well, I don't say you should take your spies and tell them just compliment them. I'll give you a reward. They should be locked up for a while, no doubt about that. But, in general, death penalty, not according to the lucky concept, is an impossibility almost.
The notion I brought in, the fact is that he indicated, Judge Hoffman indicated that he looked at his God.
But this is exactly what I don't like.
Judgment.
This exactly is exactly
about this case, and that's why I believe Rabbi Rachman and perhaps others went to see him in terms of trying to interpret his God, if you will,
he
was appealing to a greater.
This is exactly what I disliked about it. The story that he walked into the temple and consulted his God, but it's a funny God, and he was not. It's a McCarthy God, not a Jewish God. I don't know whether a man was sincere or not. I'll tell you something I don't know. I have no right to judge as you said. Well, since you pressed me for an answer.
Yes, Jekyll, we do have a right to question whether, in terms of the statement that we're quoting around the table that the judge had made, whether this was and is in line with.
Yes.
And in what way can you rationalize, if you will, that this is possible?
What's possible?
Rationalization that he took.
No, to me, it's not rational.
Well, obviously, many of us around the table say that it is not possible, but
to introduce Judaism, the God of Israel, into this, so to say, institution, the death penalty, for small people who apparently did not do much damage to the face of the United States, it was, and of course, it was not converted. The less relevant to one's kerygma is, that means his message to society, his contribution, the more concerned society must be with his inner pride and dignity. This is in Judaic concept. You have here a Bible, I mean, in English? Yes. If you take Leviticus 19:14, gentlemen. 19:14. You have it? Excuse me, gentlemen. Yes. Yes, 19:14. Thou shalt not curse the deaf, nor put a stumbling block before the blind, but shalt fear thy God, I am the Lord. You shalt not curse the deaf, and you should not put a stumbling block before the blind. You shall fear thy God, I am the Lord. It means, I don't tolerate it. The deaf and blind, why only the deaf? Am I allowed, permitted to curse anybody who still can hear the curse uttered? Certainly not. But with the deaf one, against whom nature has discriminated, the cripple, Judaism has a unique approach with regard to that one. The deaf and the blind are representatives of the class of people handicapped physically and socially anonymous. The deaf person cannot accomplish much, unless he's an Edison or a Beethoven. And lonely, the Torah singles them out. Be careful not to vex or cause any harm to them. Then, for instance, if we'll take another sentence, just, I'll tell you just where it is. Yes, it is Exodus 23:20, chapter 23, verse 20. Thou shalt neither vex a stranger, nor oppress him, for ye are strangers in the land of Egypt. Ye shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. If thou afflict them in any wise, and they cry at all unto me, I will surely hear their cry. And my wrath shall wax hot, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall be widows, and your children fatherless. Very severe words.
Yes, sir. The anti-Maimonidean conflict, the Kabbalist, the Karaite, the Lebanon controversy, the Hasidic, Elijah Gordon versus Islam.
Yeah.
Would that be included within the Maldin Mechavero or not?
You mean certain acts on the part of the Lebanon against dissidents, yes?
All through the centuries we've had.
Against dissidents. Against dissidents. Yes. Perhaps yes. I'll be very frank with you. Perhaps yes. Perhaps it was wrong. regardless of the fact that such a great authority as the Gaon of Vilna did it. Regardless of that. I don't believe it wasn't conformity to the Jewish ethics.
My question is whether a statement like that is a wish, an ideal, a flash, which has not become rooted as such in Jewish life, or whether it was a guiding principle.
You are right. Whether it's just an ideal or Christianity, an ideal which have never been put into effect. Yes, a good question. I believe, and I am very objective about it, I try to treat it in this detached manner. It's no use, I mean, romanticizing our past, or trying to weave, our fantasy should weave a halo around, I mean, around our heroes. I believe the certain exceptions, more or less, it was reality. The certain exceptions. Because human beings, however great, cannot, many times, cannot control themselves. But the certain exceptions, thou shalt neither react. Why widow and orphan? They shouldn't oppress anybody. Why are they widow and orphan? Why are they not to wax the stranger? And the resident citizen, you're allowed to wax? You're allowed to know? You're allowed to embarrass? No. I mean, the law, my mind says the law applies to everybody. But why did the Torah single out the stranger, the orphan, and the widow? Yes, as I said before. The widow, the orphan, the stranger are typical of a class of people who are the selfless, the weak, and occupy a very anonymous station in society. It is the symbol of anonymity. And there is specific emphasis placed upon hurting the anonymous individual. Because if you hurt the present United States, he can recover from the shock. But if you hurt an anonymous individual, the shock can be so powerful that he'll never recover from it. I mean mentally, everything, emotionally. Maimonides writes, if you want to know the source, it is Deot. Deot means virtues. The book which deals with virtues, 6:9. A man ought to be especially heedful of his behavior toward widows and orphans, for their souls are exceedingly depressed and their spirits low. One must not speak to them, address himself to them, otherwise than tenderly. One must show them unwavering courtesy, not hurt them physically, with hard toys, nor wound their feelings, or hurt with harsh words. Whoever irritates them, provokes them to anger, pains them, tyrannizes them, or even shames them, or hurts their pride, is guilty of a transgression, and still more so, if one beats them or curses them. Again, the station of the non-prominent citizen. Remarkably, the story revealed in the Michilta, it's a Midrash. It's a strange story. Strange story, it's very typical. You know the history of the 10 martyrs, I mean, the famous Asara Rudin Malchut, I mean, the 10 martyrs during the Roman occupation of Palestine. Among them were the greatest Jewish scholars like Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Gamliel, and Rabbi Ishmael. They're actually the fathers of the Talmud and Talmudic halakha in Judaism. Martyrs, because, there was a wave of religious persecution, and they did not conform to the Roman edict prohibiting enjoining Jews from practicing their religion. So the story, and it looks to be quite historical. The story is mentioned twice. Once in Michilta and another Talmudic book. When Rabban Gamliel was the Duke of the Jews, he was simply occupied the place of the king. The prince, he was called Rabban Gamliel the prince. And Rabbi Ishmael, the high priest, he was the high priest, who were sentenced to death and taken to the place of execution, Rabban Gamliel, the prince, began suddenly to sob, to cry. Rabbi Ishmael, it's almost a little translation, addressed himself to his colleagues and said, it's literal, Prince in Israel, Nisi Israel, Prince in Israel, why do you cry? Just a few steps separate us, or thou, thee, from our Father in heaven. And he said it, in Hebrew it's still nicer, in a few short moments you'll be sitting in the lap of the Shekhinah, you know what Shekhinah means. which is divinity as a mother. Divinity symbolized as a mother, not as a father. Rabban Gamliel answered, I'm not frightened by the past of death. I'm not afraid of departure. I cry because we are going to be executed like ordinary criminals, while we did not commit any offense for which we would have to suffer the death penalty. Simply, he doesn't understand why he's killed. The last question, why? A martyr, a saint, about to incur, to sacrifice himself on the altar for the perpetuation of Jewish tradition and Jewish people, and they are the ones who saved the Jewish people from disintegration. By their example, by their fortitude and boldness. Yes. So I may ask a question. It's a question, what do you call a question which belongs in theodicy, the problem of evil. Why? Why did God do that? So Rabbi Ishmael answered, and the answer is what I keep saying, my prince and master, the world, Nisi Yisrael, Rabbi Umair, my prince and master and teacher, permit me to say something to you. So Rabbi Gamliel said, all right, go on. Perhaps once you were taking an afternoon nap, and while you were dozing off, a poor woman with a loaf of bread came into your house to inquire of you whether or not the bread was clean or unclean. It means now we say we come with a problem of meat, whether the meat is kosher or not kosher. In that period, they observe the laws of cleanliness with regard to bread. So when a poor woman calls the rabbi, comes into the rabbi with a chicken to take a look and say whether the chicken is kosher, at least that time, they didn't speak about chickens, about fowl, they spoke about kikot. Loaves of bread. Well, the bread is clean or unclean. It means fit according to law for consumption or not. It means simply I came with a problem, whether or not it was clean or unclean. And your servant or butler told us to wait a while until you will come out of your bedroom. He went into the bedroom and wakened Rabbi Gamliel from his sleep, the prince. But of course, he can't jump out of bed and go out into the waiting room. He had to get dressed. So it took him a few moments to get dressed. And while you were dressing, the lonely widow sighed and felt hurt. She thought that if the person who came to the prince were more prominent, Rabbi Gamliel would have come out. Had been more prominent, he would have come out right away. All she had to wait is 5 seconds until he got dressed. Dressing in all the time didn't take as much as it takes us now. You see, you, my prince and master, know that the penalty for such a transgression means to oppress the widow, is Boraktias from the forest, and I'll slay the This paradoxical story is very unique. Not only was every woman whose mind was bothered by a problem allowed to approach the prince in Israel, apparently there was no telephone, no appointment, Israel, for me. If Israel would have received visitor, had received visitors by appointment only, the whole problem couldn't have developed. You see, so she opened the door and walked in. And Rabbi Gamliel, not an ordinary rabbi, this was the king of Israel, the prince. You see, after the prince and master of the Jewish community, a man was barred from the gate of the palace, whether he lived in the palace or not, I don't know, in a humble hut. But the prince was duty-bound to receive her at once, not to let her wait, lest she might feel hurt. Moreover, the Torah expects the prince to leave strict instructions with his valet that he must wake him up in a case of inquiry is made by some unknown person, then he must step out right away, immediately, of his bedroom in order, to attend to this. And the penalty for it is death. Of course. It is almost impractical. Impractical. It's impractical. It is an ideal. But, you know, we see about the Talmud was a bit Freudian about dreams. He said, the Talmud also said, dreams reflect the personality. Ideals also reflect the religious culture.
Means we shouldn't have any waiting list in our
age. Sure, I mean that. I mean, but instead of addressing myself to you, I should address myself to myself. I shouldn't have people wait. I'm just as sinner as all of us.
There's something I think you can come as a result of a very puritanical kind of attitude towards living and.
You mean if men should become completely not critical, so to say, and accept everybody? Yes, of course. But as I said to you before, Judaism has also... You see, Judaism operates with the thesis and antithesis, I mean. How come with a gathered community what Judaism requires, I mean? Because it simply sometimes demobilizes and paralyzes action, I mean, this tender approach. But it is in Judaism. I'm just reporting, nothing else. And I say reporting about elementary things, I mean, there's nothing which I... This manifestation of peculiar considerateness, perseverance and tenderness toward the lowly and meek ones on the part of Judaic ethics can only be understood if seen the light of the imitatio Dei idea that men should imitate God. I emphasized in my previous lecture, or perhaps two lectures before, that men can reach God only as a forlorn, helpless, lonely being, not as a powerful. If men come into the temple or into the synagogue as a judge, as Kaufman did, so he has no contact. A judge is an authority. He wields power. There is no contact with God. Men endowed with power cannot approach God. Who can approach God? The man who is priest of everything. Forgotten by everyone. Men forsaken and forgotten by everyone. No company, no friendship. Save God. Only God. The prophets emphasize time and again that God, the master of creation, of the great cosmic drama, of the innumerable galaxies, and the uncharted planes of the universe, humbles himself to commune with the individual and abide in the tents of the poor and the oppressed. Sustenance of reality as a whole, in total, on the one hand, and support of the lonely person, on the other hand, are two pursuits in which God engages with equal concern and love. And, for instance, we'll take Isaiah. Where is it? Yes, it's Isaiah... The last chapter, it is 46. No, it's 66. 66 verse 1 and 2. Correct? Thus says the Lord, the heaven is my throne, and the earth is my footstool. It means complete mastery over the universe. Where is the house that ye build unto me? And where is the place of my rest? It means God is infinite. For all those things have my hand made, and all those things have been, says the Lord, but to this man will I look, even to him that is poor and of a contrite spirit, and trembles at my word. Oh, on the one hand, infinity, what we call in Hebrew is pashtus, God is infinite, and God can become so small. So we say infinitesimal, that he can come in the low tent of the poor person. Kabbalah call it Ein Sof, infinity, and Tzimtzum, complete contraction on the part of God. He fits in into the smallest tent. He doesn't fit in into the cosmos, he fits also in into the smallest form. God exalted. for the whole creation, far and transcendent, is concerned with the poor and contrite spirit. He seeks the company of the lowly and addresses himself to him. Now I ask you, I mean, did you have the vehicle of us?
Yes, not yet.
Now, at the end, interesting is, at the exit of the Shabbos, of the Sabbath, it's very interesting. Yes, at the conclusion of the Sabbath, it's very interesting. When a Jew actually, I mean, recites the prayer, the first prayer of the weekday, of Chor. So at the end of this prayer, so the Jew quotes a passage from the Talmud. Rabbi Yochanan says, wherever you find the Lord greatest mentioned, you find his gentleness indicated. This is so in the Torah, again in the prophets, and the third time in the Psalms. It is written in the Torah, the Lord your God is the supreme God, the supreme Lord, the great God, mighty and revered, who is never partial and never takes a bribe. And immediately afterwards it says, he secures justice for the orphan and the widow, and loves the stranger, giving him food and clothing. Great, but the great God humbled himself to be the companion of the stranger. Can the President of the United States invite himself some foreigner if he's not a diplomat? I mean, even about Roosevelt, I mean, I read, I don't know whether it was true or not, Farley wrote it, but I take it as true that Mrs. Roosevelt said once to him, my husband cannot relax in company of such people who are culturally not equal. He's equal. I mean, you know, it's a very natural statement, though nothing derogatory about it. I cannot relax either. I mean, a company, I mean, of people who are culturally below me. And I imagine someone is superior to me cannot relax in my company. So there is not democracy. But God, the greatest of all, can relax. I may use this word, perhaps blasphemous. Well, it's maybe worth relaxing the company of the ignorant, poor, and lost. Again, it is written in the prophets. Thus says the high and lofty one, who inhabits eternity, whose name is holy. I dwell in the high and holy place, and in me. Sing to God, sing praises to his name, extol him, who is in heaven. Lord is his name, and exalt before him. And immediately afterward it says, a father of orphans, a champion of widows, is God in his holy habitation. His commission. A man should not only be high, he should be low. He should be not only cultured, sometimes uncultured, be able to speak with the most primitive breath. This is an ability, gentlemen. As a rabbi, I know, I couldn't. Sometimes it's primitive breath, particularly in religion, certain comes, it's such primitive ideas. Primitive ideas, superstition. Of course, I mean, sometimes the boundary line between the religious lofty ideals and superstition is simply so blurred that people don't know. And it comes to me many times with such foolish questions, and many times I display impatience. A woman comes to me, her husband died, and she is afraid that the spirit of her husband is still abides in her home, because at night she puts away the dishes, and then she finds the dishes in a different place. Of course, it's a question of atherosclerosis. I mean, she simply forgets. She's an elderly woman. She forgets. She herself puts away the dishes. Yes, you see. So, I mean, there can be different attitudes on the part of the rabbi how to treat this woman. You see, it's a question of patience. And patience is always, of course, you can train yourself to be patient. I believe social workers don't need any instruction in that. But it's also a question of axiological appraisal, how you appraise. If you look upon her as your equal, because she has intrinsic worth, you and I will be patient. But if you look down upon her and him, then patience is a very difficult virtue. You have to constrain yourself to be patient. And the idea is not to constrain oneself to be patient. The idea refers to inner esteem, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, to inner esteem, to appreciate. The lower spirit as perhaps as noble as my, so to say, sophisticated. This is exactly what Judaism is. Not only perseverance, but it also can be a mechanical just quality. I mean, synthetic. Judaism isn't believing. On the contrary, Judaism does not believe that it has to cover up feelings.